Hey, everybody, it's Andy. Welcome back to the North Point Community Church podcast. Hey, at the end of this episode, please take a moment to subscribe to our YouTube channel and download our free North Point app where you can access all of our recent message content. And actually, the app is the easiest way to share all this content with a friend, and it's the easiest way to keep up with everything going on around here at North Point. But most importantly, I hope the following presentation inspires you to take your next step in your faith journey. Enjoy. So today we are wrapping up our series, Me and My Big Mouth, and I'd like to emphasize me and my big mouth because I'm so glad this series is over because I have felt so accountable, and I'm trying to think of something to talk about in our next series that's a lot easier for me to apply. But this is difficult for all of us. In fact, right out of the gate, James, the brother of Jesus, which is such a cool thought that we have a letter or document, first century document from James, the brother of Jesus, he gives us the bottom line, and we've talked about this, we've repeated this, and so this is our last time to look at this together for a while. He said, and I don't know how you improve on this. I don't know how it could get any better. His bottom line, our bottom line for this series was really simple. It's we are to be quick to listen and slow to speak. Quick to listen, slow to speak. This is a game changer for relationships. This is a game changer in family. Everybody benefits when everybody does this. Be quick to listen and slow to speak. So our last time to say this all together. So everybody in all of our churches, and if you're driving, if you're watching by yourself, or you're sitting at home with a friend, here we go. All together. Ready? Quick to listen, slow to speak. A little quicker this time. Ready? Quick to listen, slow to speak. And the other thing that James said that was a little bit disheartening is he said that we never get control. In other words, our mouths are untamable. They will always need a guard. They cannot be domesticated. It is never safe to ignore your mouth because we never know what's going to come out of them. It's always a threat to our relationships. It's always a threat to the things and the people that are most valuable to us. Then last week, we look at a passage where the Apostle Paul actually gave us a couple of word pictures. He said, you should let, and I challenge you to memorize this little statement. He said, let no unwholesome word, in other words, let no distasteful word, that's what that means. Let no smelly, stinky words come out of your mouth. Let no unwholesome word come out of your mouth. And so we decided that we were all going to try to avoid fish mouth. We were all going to try not to be this guy. No distasteful, dishonoring, disrespectful words. Because if you're not even a religious person, I mean, this is just good advice. I mean, this is how you want people to talk to you for sure. But if you're a Christian, we believe that everybody we have conversations with was made in the image of God. And if they're important to God, how dare we dismiss them with our words or use distasteful words to someone who is precious in the eyes or the sight of God? So again, he kind of lifts us up and sort of raises the bar. But then he gives us another word picture that's really helpful. He said, we should approach every conversation as if it is a construction site and that our words are actually building materials. That as a result of talking to us, when we walk away from conversations, when we walk away from construction sites, people should be better off. They should be built up. And then he kind of got up in our business a little bit. And the Apostle Paul says, hey, I need to kind of go to the root of what is the issue for some of you. For some of you, the reason you have such a hard time controlling your mouth isn't what's happening around you now. It's what happened to you a long time ago. That there were words spoken over you. There were words spoken to you. There were words spoken about you that have haunted you ever since. And you've become bitter. And he says, you, if you're going to get this right, you must get rid of all bitterness because it's difficult to be a builder if you're bitter. And of course, the way you get rid of bitterness is forgiveness. And forgiveness is deciding that someone in the past doesn't owe you. It's deciding I'm going to give someone in the past what they don't deserve. So I can give people, the people around me now, what they do deserve. That's what forgiveness is. I'm going to decide you don't owe me. I'm going to give people from my past what they don't deserve so I can give the people around me what I do deserve. And if we are able to gather up our bitterness and our anger and take it to the street and leave it there, then we have the potential to become the heroes in our own stories. And the reason this is such a big deal, I mean, you know this, hurt people, what do? Oftentimes they hurt people. Bullied people have a tendency to bully people. Neglected sons become absent fathers. Neglected sons become demanding husbands. Abandoned daughters become suspicious wives, and on and on and on it goes. There is a brand, and you know this because maybe this is your story, or maybe the story of someone that's close to you. There is a brand of hurt from the past that brands us with a desire to hurt the people around us, and we don't know where it's coming from. But here's the good news. If you do the work, if I do the work, if we do the work of gathering up our bitterness and getting rid of our bitterness, again, we have the opportunity to be the hero in our own stories. But it goes beyond simply forgiving people from the past. And it goes beyond simply loving people around us. We have the potential of being the hero in our own story because of something I want to talk about today. Because every once in a while, not for everybody, but every once in a while, and for more people than you might think, and maybe this will be part of your story, even though you cannot imagine this being a part of your story when you think about your current story. Every once in a while, what goes around comes around. And the powerless find themselves in a position of power. The people who hurt you may someday need you. And how you leverage your words when the people who hurt you need you, how you leverage your words in those moments says more about you than anything else. And I want you to be ready. So today, I'm going to tell you what I think might be the second greatest story ever told. If the greatest story ever told is the story of God loving this rebellious race enough to send his son to pay for our sins, then perhaps the second greatest story ever told is a story that mirrors that same idea that happened long, long before Jesus came to earth. Now, if you started reading your Bible at the very beginning in Genesis, it'll take you a long time to get to Jesus. But if you start in Genesis, you're not there for too long before you run into a guy named Abraham. And that's where our story begins. God appeared to Abraham, or spoke rather to Abraham, and said, I'm going to make you into a family that becomes a nation, and through you, I'm going to bless the entire world. And Abraham and Sarah had to wait a while, but they finally had a son named Isaac. And then Isaac eventually had two sons, and one of them was named Jacob, but doesn't look like much of a nation. In fact, it's not even much of a family. And then suddenly things pick up steam because Jacob had 12 sons. And suddenly we're on the verge of some tribes, and suddenly we're on the verge of maybe, you know, 2 or 3, 4 generations later, you've got a small nation, especially by ancient standards. But the interesting thing about this story is that the entire enterprise, the entire promise to Abraham, God's, you know, goal for what he wants to do, this plan of redemption for the whole world through the centuries, the entire plan would end up hanging by the thread of one person's words. In fact, the entire enterprise could have easily fallen apart based on a single sentence from one single person. And that one single person actually was one of Jacob's sons, and his name was Joseph. Now, Joseph was Jacob's favorite son because he was the son of Jacob's favorite wife. Okay, he had two wives and a couple of other ladies he had children from. So here's kind of a takeaway for today. Men, never have a favorite wife, okay? It will cause problems. And it caused so many problems for Jacob because he had a favorite wife named Rachel and had a son named Jacob. And Jacob was his favorite son. And then Rachel gave birth again to a boy they named Benjamin, but she died in childbirth. So he was constantly mourning the loss of his favorite wife, and consequently, Joseph became his favorite son. So Benjamin's too young to be a part of this narrative, but Joseph had these, for the most part, older brothers, we think, and all 10 of these older brothers despised him and resented him because they knew their father loved him more than he loved the rest of the boys. So as the story goes, and if you grew up in church or if you're Jewish, you know this story. One day, Jacob says to Joseph, I want you to go check on your brothers, which Joseph hated to do, and the brothers hated it even more. And so Joseph shows up, and they see him coming, and they said, you know, we've had enough of this. This is ridiculous. They take Joseph, they strip him of his robe that his father, the special, you know, robe his father had made for him, and they throw him in a pit. That was an empty pit. It wasn't full of water, but it wasn't a pleasant place to be. And they decide, you know what, let's kill him, but before we kill him, let's have lunch. So the text says they sat down to eat their meal, and they looked up and they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Meanwhile, you know, Joseph's like, hey guys, okay, guys, you know, we don't, you know, Joseph, he's got to be scared to death. He's just, this is terrorizing to him because, you know, he knows how much they resent him. But they see this caravan coming. The text says, Judah said to his brothers when they saw this caravan going by, what will we gain? I mean, what good is it to us if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? And they're like, yeah, good point. Come, he said, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. And then this flood of compassion. After all, he is our brother. And all 10 went, he is our brother. And then the compassion left. And he's our own flesh and blood. So they pull him out of the pit. Of course, you know, he's terrified, just terrified. He doesn't know what's going to happen. And then he sees these strangers, and they're speaking foreign languages, plural. And they tie him by his hands, and they sell him. They sell their own brother to these slave traders. And again, if we pause long enough, we had time to create this sense of terror that had to be going through his mind. Now, Joseph, at this point, is 17 years old. He's a teenager, and he is being sold to slavers. He doesn't know who he will end up with, and he doesn't know what he will be purchased for. And they wave goodbye, and off goes Joseph. They know they will never see him again, and he assumes he will never see home again. The text continues. Now, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. And then perhaps the strangest part of the story. In fact, this is repeated throughout. It's the theme of the story. And in the midst of all of this chaos, the author tells us, and the Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered. And we think, no, if the Lord was with Joseph, Joseph would be home with Jacob, and it would be the 10 brothers that would be sold into slavery, right? Because Joseph hasn't done anything wrong. The wicked brothers are getting by with something horrible. I mean, if God is with someone, don't good things happen? And throughout this story, this is the theme over and over and over. But the more amazing thing to me, and perhaps the message for you and the takeaway for me, is that not only was God in some mysterious way with Joseph through all this, through this entire ordeal, Joseph chose to live as a man that God was with. That Joseph decided to live his life as if God was with him rather than God having abandoned him. Well, eventually, Potiphar notices Joseph is a very talented person, and years go by. Okay, the problem with the story, it's all compressed in a few chapters, but this is over the course of many years. So some years go by. Eventually, I guess he learned the language. I don't know if he could even speak the language of the people he was serving. He eventually learns the language. He's very skilled. Potiphar notices him, and he gives him more and more responsibility. And before long, after a few years, Joseph is managing Potiphar's household. And Potiphar wasn't the only person that noticed Joseph. Potiphar's wife noticed Joseph. And Potiphar's wife comes to him and says to him, and the text doesn't give us this language, but she could have used this language. She said to him, slave, because he's a slave. Slave, I require your presence. I require you to sleep with me. This isn't an ask. I'm commanding you. I own you, and slave, I want you, man, young man, to sleep with me. And for the first time, perhaps in her whole life, she got a no for an answer. Okay, traditionally in ancient cultures where there are slaves, slaves don't say no. Slaves don't say anything. Slaves just obey. And this slave, this Hebrew slave, has the audacity to say to his master's wife, no, I'm not going to do what you require me to do. And the reason he gave is amazing. The first reason was, look, your husband has put everything he owns in my charge under my authority except for you. So how can I do this? But then this next statement is amazing. He says, how then, he says to her, to Potiphar's wife, how then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? To which we think, God? You mean the God who has done nothing for you lately? The God who watched as you were sold by your brothers to who knows what for who knows what for? You mean the God who stood by and did not intercede, who did not come to your rescue? This is the God, Joseph, that you continue to be faithful to? Well, this had to have been so offensive to Potiphar's wife, because basically he accused her of trying to sin, and who knows if she even knew what he was talking about. Well, this goes on day after day after day, and he's like, no, 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 I'm not going to do it. And finally, she's had enough. And finally, she's tired of the guilt. Finally, she's tired of this rebellious slave, and she accuses Joseph of trying to rape her. When Potiphar finds out, he has no options. He takes Joseph and he puts him in, the text calls it, a dungeon. The text says Joseph's master, Potiphar, put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. And then again, the author brings us back to this theme. But while Joseph was in the prison, the Lord was with him, to which we say, no. See, if the Lord is with you, you're not in prison. She goes to prison, okay? The whole thing isn't, this is not working. Aren't good things supposed to happen to good people? And aren't bad things supposed to happen to bad people? And if you're faithful, isn't it all supposed to work out? The text says, and God, he showed him favor in the eyes. He granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. Again, who wants to have favor in the eyes of the prison warden? If you know the prison warden, things are not going well for you, okay? How is it that God is with you and you have a personal relationship with the prison warden because now you're working for the prison warden? And we're reminded of something that all of us need to be reminded of every once in a while, that bad things have been happening to good people for a long time. But the corollary is this: God has been with good people in bad times for a long time as well. Well, eventually, Joseph eventually becomes somewhat of the administrative assistant to the warden. He's kind of running the whole prison. He's just got extraordinary administrative skills. And we find out later in the story, he does not want to be there. I mean, he has some good luck. You know, he has some things work out for him, but he's miserable. And based on the description of this prison, this dungeon, it was probably underground. Who knows if he ever saw the light of day or how rare it was for him to ever be able to step outside into the sun. Well, as the story goes, Pharaoh's butler and Pharaoh's baker fall out of favor with Pharaoh, and Pharaoh has them thrown into the same prison. And of course, they meet Joseph, and time goes by. Again, years go by. And one day, the text tells us, and it's kind of funny, that one day they wake up and they see Joseph, and Joseph can tell they're down. And when I read this, I think, of course they're down. They're like down. They're like in the dungeon. Everybody's down all the time. But apparently on this particular morning, they were downer than normal down, okay? And Joseph says to them, hey, I can tell something's going on. You know, what's going on? And they both said, well, we both had dreams, and these dreams were so vivid and so real. We feel like they mean something, and we've talked about it, and we just don't know what these dreams mean. And Joseph says, well, give me a shot. I've in the past been able to interpret dreams. So they tell Joseph their dreams. And first the butler goes, he says, well, I had this dream. And Joseph listens to the dream and he says, well, I got some good news. In 3 days, it's Pharaoh's birthday. And on Pharaoh's birthday, he's going to lift up your head and restore you as his personal butler and wine taster. And then Joseph says this, it's so honest. He says, but when you're free, tell them about me. I was kidnapped from my hometown. I was kidnapped from my people. I've done nothing wrong. I do not deserve to be here. I want someone on the outside to know I'm here and to get me out of here. And of course, the butler's thinking, well, yeah, if this dream comes true and I'm restored, of course I'll remember you. Well, the baker's listening to all this. He's like, wow, that was good news. Hey, what about me? So he tells his dream to Joseph, and Joseph pauses and says, well, your head will be lifted up too. Off your body, unfortunately, and then your body is going to be impaled on a stake, and the birds are going to come and eat your flesh. Now, why Joseph felt like he had to go into all that detail for the poor baker, I don't know. I think he should have said, you know, I don't know what your dream means. We'll just have to, I don't know. Boy, we'll just, you know, let's just give it a few days. We'll wait and see. Well, sure enough, 3 days later, one of them is beheaded and impaled, and the butler is restored. And put yourself, if you can, it's difficult for us to be in this situation. Imagine, and a day goes by, and Joseph is thinking, maybe this is the day. Surely the butler is going to say to someone on the outside, oh, you're not going to believe this. There's a guy in our dungeon who predicted this very event. And 2 days go by, and three, and a week, and a month. And the text tells us that the butler forgot all about Joseph. And for some of us, that's our life story right now, isn't it? You just feel forgotten. And a year goes by. And another year goes by, and another year goes by. And for all Joseph knows, this is his lot in life for the rest of his life. But day after day after day, he continues to live as if God is with him. Now Joseph is 30 years old, and Pharaoh has a series of dreams. And he's so disturbed by these dreams, and they're so vivid. And he believes that somehow they mean something. So he calls in the court magicians, and he calls in his counselors, and he shares this dream, and nobody can come up with an interpretation for these dreams. And then the butler remembers, and he says to Pharaoh, these are my words, not the text, Pharaoh, you remember a few years ago, we had that little, you know, it wasn't a big deal, it wasn't a really big deal, but you did have me, I hate to even bring it up, you had me thrown in the dungeon for a very short time because it wasn't a big deal. Anyway, while I was there, I met a Hebrew slave and he listened to my dream and told me what would happen based on my dream. And sure enough, it happened. And I think perhaps if he's still there, I mean, who knows if he's still there? Who knows if he's still anywhere? Who knows if he's alive? It's been years. But if he's there, you should find him. So the text says that Pharaoh sent for Joseph. And he was quickly brought from the dungeon. And when he had shaved, because he was a mess, and when he had changed his clothes because he smelled like dungeon, he came before Pharaoh. Now, again, the contrast, we can't even begin to picture this. To come into the daylight for maybe the first time in a long time. Next thing you know, you're being shaved and pampered and perfumed, and suddenly, you know, what's going on? Well, Pharaoh wants to see you. Pharaoh wants to see me. Pharaoh wants to see you. Here's how far you can get to Pharaoh. Here's how you walk. Here's how you kneel. Here's how you bow. Here's the etiquette. You need to pay attention. He wants you in his presence now. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I had a dream, and no one can interpret it, but I have heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Now, what happens next is perhaps the most courageous phrase, the most courageous statement uttered by anyone, anywhere in all of history. I mean, this is Joseph's big chance. And Pharaoh says, I'm going to tell you my dream, and then I want you to tell me, you know, to give me the interpretation. But before Pharaoh can even begin telling Joseph what he dreamed, this foreigner for whom his God had done nothing for him lately says to the most powerful man on the planet, I cannot do it. And the butler thinks, hi-ho, hi-ho, it's back to the dungeon, I go. Why in the world did I bring this up and draw attention to myself and my past? This is not going to go well for me. Now, Joseph should have stopped right there, but he doesn't. He says, I cannot do it, Joseph replied to Pharaoh, but God. Now, this is even worse. He should have just stopped with, I can't do it. May I go, please? But God will give Pharaoh, who thinks he is a god, who every day of his life is reminded you are a god, that you are the son of our ultimate God. He said, but God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires. Oh, Pharaoh, you are little g god, but big g god can answer your request. Well, Pharaoh had to have been offended. Everybody in the courtroom's offended. You know, get a steak ready. But Pharaoh's like, you know what? I want somebody to tell me what this dream meant. So he said, here's the dream. He explains it to Joseph. Joseph pauses, and Joseph explains to Pharaoh what the dream means. And here's what the dream meant. You maybe remember this if you grew up in church. He said, Pharaoh, the reason you had a sequence of dreams is because God is establishing the fact that this is going to happen. And the dreams mean the same things. Egypt is going to experience 7 extraordinary years. There is going to be so much grain, your people are going to be swimming in grain. People from all over the world are going to come here and purchase your grain. It's going to kill the economy probably because the prices are going to go so low. There's going to be so much grain. But after those 7 years, there's going to be a famine. And the famine is going to be so bad that just a short time into the famine, everyone will have forgotten about all the abundance. It's going to be so bad. And so that's the interpretation of your dream. 7 years of, you know, prosperity, 7 years of famine. At which point, Joseph should have stopped talking. But then Joseph does the unthinkable. Joseph begins to give Pharaoh advice. At which point, everyone in the courtroom must have moaned. I mean, this kid still smells like dungeon. And he leans in and he says, Pharaoh, here's what you ought to do. No one speaks this way to Pharaoh. Here's what you need to do. And he kept going. He says, here's what you need to do. During the years of plenty, you need to designate certain cities in the country as granary, grain cities. You need to build extraordinarily large silos, and you need to tax the people 20% of all the grain. So for the next 7 years, you collect 20% of all the grain. And here's the kicker. And you are to do this, Pharaoh, in your name. And this is why I think Pharaoh let him keep talking. In other words, this is a tax on the grain. Nobody's going to care. They're going to have so much. And this is a tax to you personally. You will own 20% of all the grain in all of Egypt after the 7 years. Pharaoh's like, okay, keep going. This is good. Then after the 7 years, when the famine hits and the rain stops and the crops die and the locusts come, then at the right time, somebody needs to pay attention. You're going to open these grain silos, these cities where all these stores of grain are, and don't give it away. Sell it to the people. Pharaoh's like, I see where this is going. Keep going. Sell it to the people. And this is going to be such a big, complicated thing. You're going to need to find somebody to put in charge of this, because somebody cannot take their eye off this ball for the next 7 years. Somebody needs to wake up every single day for the next 7 years working on this and then managing it on the back end. Silence. The plan seemed good to Pharaoh and all his officials. So Pharaoh asked him, can we find anyone like this man, one in whom is the Spirit of God? Now, when Pharaoh asks a question and he kind of telegraphs what he wants the answer to be, everybody in the courtroom gives him the answer he wants because he's a god. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has made all of this known to you, not only what's going to happen, but what we should do about it, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace." And of course, the people who think they're second, third, and fourth in line are like, wait. Okay, we've known this kid 45 minutes, and you're about to put him in charge of the whole, but you don't, it's Pharaoh. You don't do that. "He's going to be in charge of my palace. All my people, they're to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you." And he makes Joseph the prime minister of Egypt. Whew. Joseph gets to work. We know he's efficient. He trained in Potiphar's household, but he didn't know he was training. He trained in the dungeon. He didn't know he was training. And now he has a responsibility of saving a nation. And he gets to work and he builds the storehouses and he chooses the city and he organizes the whole thing. And for 7 years, they tax the grain. And 20% of the grain is stored. 7 years end. And I mean, the rain ceases and things get really bad. In fact, it was so bad, everybody forgot, as he predicted. They forgot about the good years. And at the right time, when the time was right, they begin to sell the grain and people spent all their money on grain. Then they traded their cattle. And this famine reached outside the borders of Egypt all the way north to where Joseph's family lived. And they begin to feel the effects. And the text says that when Jacob, Joseph's father, learned that there was grain in Egypt, this is funny, he said to his sons, the other 10 sons plus Benjamin, "Why do you just keep looking at each other? I mean, we're starving to death." He continued, "I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we may live and not die." In other words, why did I even have to cut? I mean, guys, come on. We're going to die. You've got to go down there and buy some of this grain. So the boys load up and they head to Egypt. And the stage is set. And the fortunes have been reversed. Whew. Now, Joseph was the governor of the land, the person who sold the grain to all his people. Well, look at there. And apparently the boys showed up in the very city where Joseph just happened to be on that particular day, dispensing and overseeing the dispensing of grain. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. And as soon as Joseph saw them, he recognized them, but he pretended to be a stranger. And they did not recognize him. And do you know why they did not recognize him? Because he walked like an Egyptian. That's why. They didn't recognize Joseph because he's 30 years old. And the last time they saw him, he was a scrawny little teenager probably who was terrified. Who was terrified. And the last they heard of him was him begging for mercy, and they just erased all that from their minds. And now they are in the presence of the second most powerful person on the planet as far as they were concerned. So here's the question we all have to wrestle with. And some of you are not wrestling with this now, but you will in the future. I just want you to be ready. What do you do when you've got the power and your words determine the destiny of your enemy? What happens when things turn around, when what goes around came around? What happens when you've got the power and your words determine the destiny of your enemy? And the answer to this question depends upon what you did with your bitterness and your anger. And if you are still dragging it around when this happens, you will be like the people you don't like. And as his boys were bowed down before him, I'm sure the things that he just remembered, those nights with the Ishmaelites, hearing them laughing by the campfire, wondering, where am I going? What's happening to me? Who knows what happened to him or how he was treated along the way? The prayers that weren't answered, standing on that auction block, stripped naked with people walking around, checking him out from every angle, deciding who should purchase him, what he was worth and what he would be good for, what he could be used for. The lie told by Potiphar's wife, just when things at least were, you know, in some sort of semblance of order and something, you know, a life that he could possibly survive, and being thrown once again into the dungeon. And there before him are the men responsible for all of that. For the next three chapters, you should read it. For the next three chapters, he plays with them. he says, well, I think you're spies. And they're like, no, we're not spies. You know, do you have any other brothers? Yeah, we got a younger brother. Okay, I want you to go and bring him, and one of you is going to stay here as a hostage. They're like, oh, no, yeah, if you want grain, he gives them grain. They go, and for several months, they're back and forth. He accuses them of being spies. Then he sets them up and, you know, basically makes it look like Benjamin stole something of value. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And basically, he's testing them to see, have they changed? Are they still the men that I remember when I was 17? And I don't know, but I'm guessing he had to have been wrestling with his own emotions as well. What do I do? What do you do when you've got the power? And your words determine the destiny of your enemy. And the text says, as this whole story escalates, and there's so much detail, months again go by. And finally, they're all back in Egypt. And he gets them in a room, and he has his attendants and his guards. And then he does something that completely freaked them out. The text says that Joseph could no longer control himself before all of his attendants. And he cried out, have everyone leave my presence. And suddenly they are alone in the room with this guy who has given them so much attention, and they just can't figure out, why has he singled us out? Why all of this interaction with this? Why are we anyone to this person? So there was no one in the room. There was no one in the room when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. Imagine this moment. And Joseph said to his brothers, he'd been waiting for this, I am Joseph. And they wetteth themselves. Okay, that's not in the text, but their bowels released. Because they expected him to do unto them what they had done unto him. With one word, 10 stakes in the courtyard to be impaled. And the way it worked back then, you didn't impale everyone at one time. Oh no, that was too quick. You had the 9 sit in a group with their hands tied as they watched the one slowly impaled on a sharp pointed stake. And then you watched as he slowly died. And not to be too graphic, you died when the stake finally reached your heart because of the weight of your body. And then the second brother, this would take hours and hours. It could take more than a day. That's what awaited them. Joseph said, is my father still living? That's it. Is my father still? He had no idea what was happening back at home. But his brothers, of course, this makes perfect sense. But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified in his presence. Because they were rehearsing as well what was said and what was done and what would probably happen to them. But they did not need to be terrified in his presence because Joseph had lived as if God was with him during his absence. And he kept bitterness at bay. What Joseph could not have known was that God's plan for the ages dangled by the thread of his one word. That before him sat the 10 tribes of the 12 tribes of Israel, through whom God would introduce the Savior of the world, who would do for the world exactly what Joseph ultimately did for his brothers. The Savior of the world who would do for you exactly what Joseph would ultimately do for his brothers. Forgive them. Because he didn't carry around a bag of bitterness and a sack of anger, even though he had every reason in the world to do so. He has them stand up, embraces all of them, and says, you're to go home, you're to get dad, you're to get your families, your grandfamily, your kids. I want to know all your kids' names. Bring pictures. I want to know what's been going on. I've been missing out. I want you to go home. I'm going to send as much grain as you'll ever need. I'm going to send an armed escort. I want you to bring them all back, and I'm going to care for you for the rest of your lives. And he does. And years go by. And then Jacob, their father, dies. And the 10 get together and go, uh-oh. That's what he was waiting for. He got us here. We have been his hostages all along. He was just waiting for daddy to die. And once daddy dies, now he's going to exact his vengeance on us. And his brothers, the text says, they came to him and they threw themselves down before him and they said, "We are your slaves. We sold you into slavery. If you'll spare our lives, if you will spare our children's lives, if you will spare our grandchildren's lives and the lives of our people, we are your slaves." But Joseph said to them, "Do not," this is so powerful, "do not be afraid." And then here's the question that you're going to have to ask yourself at some point in your life. "Am I," Joseph says, "in the place of God?" Not "am I God?" I know I'm not God, but "am I in the place of God?" So listen to this. You will never experience, I've seen this played out, some of you it's playing out right now. You will never experience the good that comes from the bad unless you recognize God was with you during the bad and then refuse to play God when things are good. You will never experience the total good that can come from the bad unless you live during those hard, tough years as if God is with you and then you refuse to play God when things are good. Joseph said, you intended to harm me, but God's bigger than that. And God was silent, but God wasn't still. It seemed like God was far away, but God was working. But God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid. You're not my slaves. I'm not going to simply not execute you. I'm going to provide for you and your children. And he reassured them, and he spoke kindly to them. Now here's the thing. One day, maybe one day soon, you may have power over the person or the persons who took from you, who hurt you, who harmed you, who stole that first marriage, who stole your childhood, who stole the opportunity you had to raise your own children. You don't know what's going to come around. And in those moments, you'll remember what they took from you, and you'll remember what they did to you. And in that moment, your Heavenly Father is going to invite you to remember something else as well. He's going to ask you to remember who was with you. And in that moment, you'll have a decision to make. What will you do? What will I do when we've got the power and our words, your words, determine the destiny of your enemy? Will you pay them back? Or will you use those words to pave the way forward? Your decision will not be determined by what's happening then. Your decision will be determined by what you do between now and then. It will be determined by the perspective you maintain between now and then. And I hope that you will take your cue from the one who gave his life to you and not from the one or the ones who took life from you. From the one who was with you and not the ones who abandoned you. And if you do, in that moment, you will be like your Father in heaven. And you will be free.